The court calls United States v. McDonald. Counsel for the appellants, please.
Court. It's a pleasure to be here today. Judge Alden, it's a pleasure to make your appointment. It's hard to be before you. Tomorrow will be my second. Your Honor, my name is William Becerra, and on behalf of the appellant, George McDonald, along with Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter and Captain Robert H. Meeks, we represent Kyle McDonald. Your Honor, the appellant was denied a fair trial and the opportunity to present his defense when a military judge denied a defense instruction on involuntary intoxication and quashed a subpoena for relevant and necessary documents related to the...
Can you hear in the back? You're getting some negatives on that. Can you play around with the microphone and with your voice as well? Thank you.
Not a complaint I get frequently, Judge.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll turn you down later, but...
And, Your Honor, and also when he quashed a subpoena for relevant and necessary documents related to the adverse effects of Chantix. With permission of the Chief Judge, I would like to start with assignment of error 2.
Is that because it's your stronger argument?
We believe it is, Judge.
Okay, thank you.
The military judge abused his discretion in denying a defense-requested instruction on involuntary intoxication and erred in failing to instruct the members on the effect of intoxication on the appellant's ability to form specific intent and premeditation. As the court knows, the standard of review is a military judge's decision to give a tailored review on a requested instruction, a tailored defense-requested instruction is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. And as the court knows from our brief, this is locked up into two issues, and we will handle the first of those issues. The first of those issues is involuntary intoxication as a complete defense. As the court knows, there is a three-prong test for determining instructional error. One is whether the requested instruction is correct. In this case, the requested instruction was a correct statement of the law. Involuntary intoxication is a complete defense if it rises to the level of insanity. And as this court knows from Deering and other cases, it is treated like...
Can you explain what that means?
What means, Judge?
The language in Hensler is not written with great clarity. It rises to the level of an affirmative defense only if it amounts to legal insanity. And then the CCA says, the defense of involuntary intoxication is similar to that of lack of mental responsibility in that the defense must prove by clear and convincing evidence that he did not appreciate the nature and quality or wrongfulness of his acts, but different in that he need not prove that he suffered a severe mental disease or defect, but rather that he was intoxicated. Now, is that the correct statement of law? Is Hensler the correct statement of law, or did the military judge get it right? Who's got it right?
His interpretation of Hensler is a correct interpretation of the law as it relates to that point, Judge, which is that it is treated like insanity and that the appellant has the initial burden. It is treated like insanity in that the defense must prove by clear and convincing evidence that the accused was involuntarily intoxicated and that as a result, here he was unable to distinguish between right and wrong.
Doesn't the statute speak of mental disease or defect?
It does, Judge.
Okay, well, is the judge simply applying the statute there and he can't go beyond it?
I think he can go beyond the statute, Judge.
If Congress defined the defense of insanity, lack of mental responsibility in a certain way, isn't the judge bound by it?
Not as a result of Hensler, no, Judge. I think that this court made it clear that that involuntary intoxication also fits within that penumbra.
Can I go back to the formula just to make sure I understand what your view is?
Absolutely.
And I'm sure the government will let me know what their view is.
Mine's
Does
right,
involuntary intoxication take the place then of mental defect or disease? And so involuntary intoxication equals the following: involuntary intoxication plus inability to perceive wrongfulness, whereas mental responsibility or lack thereof is severe defect or disease plus lack of ability to understand wrongfulness.
And so I'm clear, Judge, is the court asking about this case in specific?
No, I'm talking about, I want to know what the law is because Hensler's confusing.
I would not disagree, Judge. The law is, Your first synopsis of the law is correct, Judge, which is that it is, it doesn't take the place of insanity, but it is treated in the exact same way. Now, in this case, the court should have...
But hang on. If you say if it's treated in the exact same way, then I'm looking for a severe mental disease or defect.
No, Judge, because what we're looking for is whether or not, as a result of his involuntary intoxication, he was unable. In other words, Judge, if I may, I think that's where the real problem in this case lies, is that by failing to give that instruction, what the military judge did was left the panel with either finding there's a serious mental disease or defect, or there's nothing.
And but you could substitute, in your view, involuntary intoxication for serious mental disease or defect,
correct,
and then move on to wrongfulness.
Absolutely. Is that clear for my position, Judge?
Thank you.
And as the court knows, the instruction proffered by the defense need not be technically precise, and that's the Deering case. And in this case, there was a small problem in that the defense sort of overplayed what their burden should have been, when actually it is to prove by clear and convincing evidence and not by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The second prong is whether the requested instruction is not substantially covered in the main instruction.
Is the ultimate defense then involuntary intoxication, or is it lack of mental responsibility due to involuntary intoxication? Or does it matter?
I don't think it matters, but the ultimate defense is that as a result of involuntary intoxication, he was unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of his actions.
Thank you.
As we know in this case, as the Army Court held, the proffered instruction was not covered in the main instruction, and that the words Chantix and the words involuntary intoxication were never mentioned in the instruction. And then the third prong is whether the requested instruction is on such a vital point in the case that the failure to give it deprived the appellant of a defense or seriously impaired its effective presentation. The members may well have thought in this case, Your Honors, that the appellant had to prove an organic defect as opposed to involuntary intoxication. The Army Court got it correct when it said there was overwhelming evidence, got it incorrect when they said that there was overwhelming evidence of mental responsibility. But the only way to view that is in context. The panel was never told that it could find involuntary intoxication was a complete defense. The purpose of the instruction was to show the member that they could find that as a result of involuntary intoxication or in combination with other mental health issues, the appellant was unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of his action.
Well, what we're really concerned here is harmfulness, isn't it, counsel? The court agreed with you that it was error not to give the instruction, that the judge erred. Okay, and then they said, but in view of the overwhelming evidence of guilt and planning and trying to hide the act afterwards and talking to his girlfriend and all this other stuff, it doesn't matter because it's harmfulness. That's HBRD. How do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, for one thing, you have to look at the case in context. You cannot... It is impossible for us to know what the members would have done with the correct instruction. And there is certainly some evidence in the record, as required by Peterson, that of the appellant's involuntary intoxication. It is also, and Your Honor, this will tie more in as well with the second assignment that I'm about to argue, but it is certainly apparent from the appellant's perspective that in the millions of pages worth of documents not provided to the defense, that there is something in there that would have been relevant to the appellant. But we believe that this assignment of error stands on its own because we believe that all of those pieces of the puzzle that you just pointed to, Judge, can just as easily be attributed to the appellant's involuntary intoxication as a result of his voluntary ingestion of Chantix, but involuntarily knowing what the after effects of the drug were. So all of the things that the court just pointed to can just as easily be used to explain, well, those can be attributed to the effects of Chantix. And the panel was simply never given that opportunity. The panel was left with either you have an organic brain defect or some sort of an organic mental health defect, or you have nothing. And was never given the opportunity, and like I said previously, the words Chantix and the words involuntary intoxication simply did not come. And then there's the second prong of this argument, Your Honor, before I move into the second assignment of error, which is that involuntary intoxication can negate the elements of specific intent and premeditation. This differs from the complete defense. And in this case, in the Peterson case that we cited in our brief, voluntary intoxication requires some evidence. The burden is on the government to disprove it. If voluntary intoxication can render the appellant incapable of forming the specific intent or premeditation, then involuntary intoxication can, and that's the Higgins case. Said another word, if voluntary intoxication is enough, involuntary intoxication is certainly enough. The defense of involuntary intoxication, as it negates the elements of specific intent and premeditation, was certainly raised by the evidence, and the military judge had a sua sponte duty to instruct on it.
If the judge had a sua sponte duty to instruct, does that do anything to the burden?
Well, Your Honor, I think we could look at that one of two ways. The appellant would argue that, as a result of having put the instruction out there, that the instruction was before the judge and the burden is the same. But even if the court were to say, well, the appellant needed to request the instruction as it relates to those two specific elements as well, then yes, that does change the burden of proof. And at that point, it is an abuse of discretion standard.
So the appellant carries, in your view, the appellant carries the burden throughout, even if the judge had a sui sponte duty to give an instruction?
Except for where it rises to a constitutional level in which we go to the harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay.
And it was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. As noted, we are the appellant was denied a complete defense about as it relates to involuntary intoxication, and he was denied the right to present the defense as it related to specific intent. Your Honors, we presume the panel followed the law. We presume the panel followed the instructions. As a result, we can also presume that they didn't follow an instruction that they were not given. Back to my second assignment of error, the first assignment of error raised in the brief. The Army Court of Criminal Appeals erred in determining that the military judge's error in quashing a subpoena issued to Pfizer Incorporated to produce relevant and necessary documents regarding clinical trials, adverse event reports, and post-market surveillance of the drug varenicline, I'm hoping I got that right, was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard of review is the military judge's decision to quash is reviewed for abuse of discretion, but again, when constitutional error is involved, the standard is harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. And again, Judge Stuckey, the Army Court found error, the government did not appeal. We believe that the court is bound by that finding of error. In this case, the relevant and necessary evidence as found by the Army Court was required to be turned over for several reasons. The Wooderidge case from this court, the material was unique. The material at issue constitutes a potentially unique source of evidence that is not necessarily duplicated by any other material. The summaries provided by the FDA are not the same as what Pfizer may have had.
Did the FDA have the underlying stuff, or do we know?
We know that Pfizer had it.
We know that Pfizer had it. Did the FDA have it?
And I think if you follow the paper trail in this case, Judge, I think it's pretty easy to conclude that they did because...
Did not?
No, that they did.
Did.
Because as you get, you know, as the government points out, that's where these reports come from.
Yeah.
You know, they go from Pfizer to the FDA, so one has to assume that the FDA had them.
Hang on. Your Venn diagram then has Pfizer, and it's a circle on top of a circle when it comes to what FDA had?
I think Pfizer is a smaller circle. No, Pfizer would be the bigger circle.
No, they're the bigger circle, but the way you just responded to Judge Stuckey suggests that everything Pfizer had, FDA had.
That's a way I understood your
answer. In which case, the two circles are on top of each other.
Well,
and the, one of the questions, whether it's an important question or not, is a different matter, is the universe of what FDA had the same as what Pfizer had?
Judge, can I get back to that on my rebuttal? Because I want to make sure I give the court the right answer.
And you don't have to use a Venn diagram, which exhausts my knowledge of anything. But that is it could be an important question.
And I want to make sure I give the court the correct answer, so I'll come back with that answer. And the other important factor in this is the government believed at trial that the material was necessary and relevant because they're the ones that provided the subpoena. And according to the Morris case, which is cited by ACCA, the government says, or the Army Court says that it would not create a reasonable doubt that did not otherwise exist. But it's distinguishable in this case because in Morris, if the court recalls, the military judge had the material and was able to review it in camera. In this case, Your Honors, we literally have a million pages worth of material plus that we have no idea of what it says. We have some idea of what it says. We know that it says more than the adverse event reports. But for the Army Court to say, in this million-page universe, There is no chance that it would have helped the appellant in his defense. Quite frankly, defies logic. What we need to know, Your Honors, is why the black box warnings were issued. Plain and simple.
But doesn't that go to the material that the FDA had rather than the material, all of the material that Pfizer had? Because they're the ones who issued the black box warning.
Exactly, Your Honor. So, and Judge, I think this actually will help answer your earlier question in my last couple of seconds. Pfizer has an amount of information. They provide the summaries of that information to the FDA. The FDA, based on that, issues the black box warning. There was enough in just the AERs to issue the black box warning. One can certainly imagine that, again, in this almost infinite universe of paperwork, that there was other material in those papers that would have been relevant and necessary to the preparation of the defense and to the appellant's defense.
So is it your suggestion, then, that Pfizer is withholding incriminating, damaging reports about its drug from the FDA?
No, absolutely not, Judge. In fact, if you look at the motion for appellate discovery, which I believe is in the joint appendix, but if it's not, we can cite it to you. If you look in that, Your Honors, they provided this information as a result of the class action litigation that was going on, where they were defendants in a massive products liability suit. So they're not withholding the information.
Well, then, if they're not withholding the information, and if you were able to get information from the FDA, what is it that you're complaining about?
No, Judge, and again, I think that helps me clarify the question that they answered. What Pfizer has is the broad umbrella of information. What they provide to the FDA is the siphoned-in, smaller area of information.
That's negative.
I'm sorry?
That's negative. They provide the smaller subset of negative information to the FDA.
I wouldn't say it was negative. You mean negative as in there was no findings? Or am I misunderstanding your question?
No, negative as it's bad
information. Oh, okay, got it. I thought you meant negative as there was nothing in there. Okay, yes, which shows that the drug has very serious adverse effects, and in fact, it is the only one of the psychotropic drugs in which homicidal ideation is specific.
And that information was provided or was accessed by the defense expert at trial, was it not?
It was.
Just as a practical question, is it reasonable to expect a military judge to sit down in camera and go through a million pages of documents that they're not trained to interpret?
Well, Your Honor, I can tell you that in the civilian courts, and I know that I think it is certainly possible in the military courts for the judge to simply appoint a military master, you know, or to appoint somebody, a taint team or something, to help them review that documentation. I think the military judge has broad powers and could certainly have done so. Subject to any further questions of the court? Thank you, Your Honor.
You'll have additional time on rebuttal. Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Daniel Goldberg, and I, with Major Catherine Bradley, represent the government in this matter today. We ask that you affirm the findings and sentence for two reasons. First, the quashing of the subpoena was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And second, the denial of the involuntary intoxication instruction is also harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Turning to the first assignment of error.
Do you mind turning to the second one, mimicking counsel? It's not just to trick you and throw you off your pace, but the appellant said that was the better of his issues.
Yes, Your Honor. As the Army Court found, even if the military judge had given involuntary intoxication instruction, it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the panel still would have found appellant guilty. Per this court's ruling in Hensler, involuntary intoxication is treated like legal insanity. It is defined in
terms... Okay, what's that mean?
It's defined in terms of mental responsibility. In other words, Your Honor, the behavior of the appellant, I'm sorry, of the accused, would have to fit the definition of legal insanity. So in other words, you would have to abide by Article 50 Alpha of UCMJ.
So wait, to prove, let me make sure I understand this then. To prove involuntary intoxication, he'd have to prove that he had not only was involuntarily intoxicated, but had a severe mental disease or defect?
He would have, I beg your pardon, Your Honor, his intoxication would have to rise to the level of a severe mental disease or defect.
Which is not the same as saying he had it, right? Or what is the government saying? The government seems to say, the judge seemed to say, and the government, I thought, said in your brief, that disease or defect means disease or defect, and if you don't have it, you don't have it, and there's no reason to give the instruction. Or what are you saying?
It would have to be severe disease or defect, Your Honor. I would look to U.S. v. Peterson for the definition.
Well, no, wait a minute.
Yes, sir.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that the intoxication produces the effect of a disease or defect and negates responsibility under classic McNaughton principles? Or are you saying that there has to be some pre-existing disease or defect on which the intoxication worked to create classic McNaughton lack of responsibility? Or what are you saying?
The former, Your Honor. Once again, looking to United States versus Peterson, there must be some evidence that the intoxication was of the severity to have had the effect of rendering the appellant incapable of forming the necessary intent, not just evidence of mere intoxication, which mirrors in a sense...
Okay, well, in that case, it certainly was error for the judge not to give the instruction because the judge seemed to be saying he had to have a disease or defect. You're not arguing that it wasn't error, right? You're just arguing it's HBRD.
We're bound by the ACCA decision.
Right.
So but your brief, as Judge Stuckey pointed out, seemed to imply that the military judge had it correct.
Yes, Your Honor. That was the granted issue.
And
so we were under an obligation to address the granted issue. But again,
the granted issue had to do with prejudice, did it not?
That would be part of the granted issue, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But it also talked about...
Well, let me ask you then to clarify Judge Stuckey's question. Did the military judge have it correct, or did the CCA have it correct?
We believe the military judge had it correct, Your Honor.
Then how could... Do you want to return to Judge Stuckey's question and answer it again?
Well, we go through the three-pronged Gibson test, Your Honor. And the three-pronged Gibson test, first off,
I think the judge just said the statute says disease or defect, or ain't no disease or defect, and therefore I'm not given the instruction.
Well, he took a look at the instruction itself, and it was wrong as a matter of law.
Is that a correct statement of law or not in the government's view, what Judge Stuckey just said characterizing the military judge's position?
Well, what
accept that as the statement of the position. Is that an accurate statement of the law or is it not?
If I interpreted what the judge said correctly, I think what he said was... That wasn't the argument that defense was putting on. They weren't putting on an involuntary intoxication defense. It was a mental responsibility defense.
So the judge was arguing the defense's case for them?
I wouldn't characterize it as arguing their case for them, but summarizing their case for them.
Well, let's pretend that the defense was actually arguing involuntary intoxication because they asked for an instruction on involuntary intoxication, as did the government, interestingly enough. Is Judge Stuckey's characterization of the military judge's position on involuntary intoxication correct or incorrect in the government's view?
I don't believe, I may have misread the record, but I don't remember his view of intoxication.
It doesn't matter. For the purpose of the question, the judge's view is that involuntary intoxication requires a severe mental disease or defect. Is that correct or incorrect?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So then what is different? So there's no delta. Getting back to a Venn diagram, mental responsibility and involuntary intoxication are the same thing in the government's view, except involuntary intoxication comes with the added bonus that you have to prove you're intoxicated.
Well, the intoxication...
What's the point of it then?
The intoxication would cause a severe mental disease or defect. Now
you've got me totally confused, counsel.
I would say that there's a spectrum
of
intoxication.
Counsel, let me just ask a simpler question. Where in the instruction that the military judge gave would a member understand that they could find a mental disease or defect by virtue of the intoxication? I mean, where in that instruction is the word intoxication, Chantix, anything like that, referenced by the military judge?
Those words did not appear, Your Honor.
So I'll ask again, where from the instruction that was given could a juror or member find that they were free to find a person not guilty because of the intoxication?
The instructions were broad and generic. They talked about mental disease or defect, but they also talked about mental responsibility,
But you don't disagree that mental responsibility and intoxication were never made the same thing, were never equated?
They were never linked, Your Honor. They were never linked. But once again, even if there was error, there was no prejudice. And the reason there was no prejudice is because the appellant demonstrated that he understood the wrongfulness of murder. When he asked his girlfriend if she would still love him if he killed someone. Such a question demonstrates that appellant understood that he was risking disapproval from someone who loved him. More significantly, appellant's behavior during and immediately after the murder demonstrates his guilty conscience. When appellant was discovered mid-attack, rather than continue as though he was under a compulsion, he assaulted a witness and escaped from the room. He also showered off the blood that covered him and then packed up the murder weapon and the bloody clothes, the incriminating evidence.
All of that accurately reflects what happened, but how does it address whether or not he was acting under the influence of this Chantix and as a result of some type of involuntary intoxication that may or may not have consisted of a mental disease or defect? I mean, that's the question. How did this drug affect him and his actions, not the actions that he took? He took those actions, that's undisputed. Was he doing that knowingly, all of that knowingly, or was he doing it under the effect of the drug?
Well, and that's why we go back to Peterson. Mere intoxication is never enough, and even looking at Article 50 Alpha Bravo, simply having a mental disease or defect is not enough. And that's why we also have to ask, does he understand the nature, quality, and the wrongfulness of his act? He certainly understood the nature and quality of the act. He understood that he was killing a human being. He also understood the wrongfulness based on all that evidence, and also his confession. He indicates that he understood it was wrong. He despised it. He hated it. He fought with himself. And also it's clear because he tried destroying...
But the appellant had two defense experts come in and say that those are all manifestations, could all be manifestations of the impact of involuntary intoxication as well. There's no question he washed off the blood. There's no question he stabbed the person 50 times or some extraordinary number, but there's a dispute as to whether that is indicative of some sort of psychotic episode or whether that is indicative of premeditation. And so the question is, why is it or is it not prejudicial that the members were not given the opportunity to assess that with the knowledge that of an involuntary intoxication instruction?
Because, again, at the end of the day, they would have had to determine whether he was mentally responsible.
And but counsel, in making that determination, right, the military judge, it's a two-part determination, right? First, they have to determine that he was suffering from a mental disease or defect, right? That was the first thing they had to decide. Then they had to decide the other things, that he was unable to appreciate the nature of his actions or the wrongfulness of his acts, right?
Yes, sir.
So what if they said, well, he's not suffering from a mental disease or defect, and so full stop then, right? And they didn't have an opportunity to determine whether involuntary intoxication met that first prong.
Well, it's the government's position that it wouldn't have mattered.
Because the other parts, you say, but we don't know about the first part because they weren't given an opportunity to decide it.
And again, Your Honor, it's the government's position that the instructions as they were broad enough and generic enough where they could have considered everything.
Well, they're generic. They're too generic. That's the problem. You have a unique defense here, which is not based on junk science. You got a black box warning. You got an enormous class action over this stuff. You've got a whole bunch of official, validated, or at least semi-validated government concern, but the members are floating out there in the ether, not knowing about any of this stuff.
Your Honor, the black box warnings were based on the ADRs, the adverse event reports, which are simply reports from people who have taken the drug. So it's not based on science. It's anecdotal.
Well, are you allowed to take Chantix and deploy today?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Could we take judicial notice of a Department of Defense instruction saying you cannot, and that there no waivers shall be granted?
If that's the case, Your Honor. If that's the case. Circling back to this case, however, there is ample evidence that appellant understood the nature, quality, and wrongfulness of his acts. And at the end of the day, that's why there's no prejudice. He understood that he was killing a human being. He understood the magnitude of that. And what's more, even in his confession, he understands how wrong it was, what he was doing, and he understood at the time that it was wrong to kill a human being.
Now, counsel, when you say that, I'm looking at Joint Appendix, page 692, where appellant says, I didn't think it was wrong.
Yes, Your Honor. And it's, unfortunately for the appellant, it's belied by everything he did during the murder and after the murder, and also other things in his own statements. He says, for example, at the very end, I wish I didn't have to... He's asked directly, what were you thinking as you were stabbing that man? And he answers, I wish I didn't have to do this. So he understands that it's wrong. On the very first page of his confession, a sort of bulletized list, he talked about how sorry he was, that he was telling himself no, that he didn't like it, and that he despised it. But he never stopped himself. So it's very clear, once again, from even what he writes in his confession, that he understands the nature, quality, and the wrongfulness, especially, of what he's done. Of course, the question to his girlfriend the night before...
No, he understands it after the fact. How do we know he understood it during the fact? Or is the test to decide whether you understand it after the fact?
Well, it would be during the fact, but also his own experts testified that delusion, that this is Dr. Pancholi, delusion is not something that you can turn off like a light switch. I think the testimony was, it's not like you're delusional at 1800 and not delusional at 1801. This is something that builds up gradually, and it lasts for a period of time.
So why isn't that consistent with, I'm sorry, Judge Ryan, did you?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, do you agree that the burden is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so even if we were to tend to agree with you that there was plenty of evidence that he knew what he did was wrong, or that you could look at the evidence that way, how can we know beyond a reasonable doubt that the members would have looked at it that way if they had known that they could rely on the Chantix for the first prong of the test?
Because, again, in his own words, he indicates that he understands the wrongfulness. It's quite clear.
That wasn't my question. I'm asking you, how could we know what the members thought that they could rely on for the first prong of the test?
I'm not sure how I can answer that question, Your Honor. Maybe I misunderstand. I beg your pardon, one last thing, and I'll turn to the first assignment of error.
I think Judge Olson had a question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're speaking about Dr. Pancholi's testimony about psychosis, you can't turn it on and off. But isn't that consistent with the appellant's testimony about being stretched thin, that this was building over a number of days? He talks to his girlfriend the day before. And where do you get this sense that it was switched off as soon as another person came on the scene of the murder?
Because he escaped, Your Honor. Because if he thought that what he was doing was right or it wasn't wrong, he would have continued with the crime. But he stopped the crime as soon as somebody saw him, somebody who could testify against him. And also, that's an interesting point about being stretched thin. The reason he says he was stretched thin was not delusion. It was because, and he states this very clearly, and he elaborates on it, he was stressed out because he was in a private and basic training environment and had been there for a long period of time. That is rational and it's grounded in reality.
He was a golden boy. He was an Eagle Scout. He'd been picked for the Academy Prep School. You know, he was going places.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, well, he may have been stretched thin, but, I question whether he was as badly treated as is implied.
That's his testimony. That's what he says in his confession, that he was being hazed and abused, or at least the physical abuse had stopped, but it was still mental. And his own word, he felt like a nasty private. Again, that's his word.
Well, since he was a golden boy and he was on his way up, which way does that cut? Does that show that, in fact, he was laboring under a mental disease or defect, or there may be some implication of it? Or where does that, as we said in law school, you had the great Harvard Law School knife that cuts both ways. Which way does this cut?
Well, it could be. There are ways I can answer this question, Your Honor, but they're not in the record. These are my personal beliefs, and that would be improper. Certainly, I can give you my personal beliefs, but again, that would be improper.
Okay, then don't.
Counsel, the 706 board in this case didn't consider the Chantix or any ramifications of that. Given that fact, how should we view their findings?
Well, I think the findings of the 706 board are legitimate because, again, at the end of the day, they found that he understood the nature, quality, and wrongfulness of his acts.
Without considering the Chantix.
Without knowledge.
They did not acknowledge the Chantix. That is correct. Turning to the first assignment of error.
On the first assignment, could you jump right to the logic of the following position. There's apparently these millions of pages or whatever. How could the CCA conclude there is no reasonable probability that anything found in the material sought would raise a reasonable doubt about appellant's mental responsibility for these offenses if no one's seen the documents?
Well, first, they, of course, took a look at the same prejudice issue based on how he behaved, the nature and quality of wrongfulness. But also, and more important with respect to your question, Your Honor, defense's expert said repeatedly at the 39A session and also at court-martial that he did not need the clinical trials, that the clinical trials were useless. And the reason why he said that was because the clinical trials were done on people who were healthy.
Now, Mr. Moore said that, but he wasn't speaking for Dr. Glenn Mullen.
I beg your pardon?
Mr. Moore said that?
That's correct.
But he wasn't speaking for Dr. Glenn Mullen, was he?
He wasn't, but Dr. Glenn Mullen actually testified that he would be relying upon what Mr. Moore came up with in the analysis that he did. So Dr. Glenn Mullen was relying on Mr. Moore. Mr. Moore said repeatedly he did not need the clinical trials. Defense counsel even said that the risks weren't even foreseen in the clinical trials. I looked at page 042 of the supplemental joint appendix, 014 of the supplemental joint appendix, and roughly pages 230 through 250 of the joint appendix, and that would be the court martial proper. Mr. Moore kept saying that the AERs were the principal tool for post-market surveillance, that the clinical trials were hundreds of thousands of people, and there was no way he could review all of them. And what's more is, again, all of what was being reported about Shantix, all of the ill effects, were coming out in the post-marketing phase. So it wouldn't have come out during the clinical trials. So we don't know what we don't know. It doesn't hold water, at least according to defense's own expert.
What about the stability studies in terms of understanding what 0.58 meant in the context of the test that was taken a year later and what impact that might have been had and what that might have measured a year earlier? My understanding, and I admit it's right up there with Venn diagrams, is that without the suitability studies, you can't determine what impact, if any, would have occurred based on how you stored that the urine in the course of the year. You can't determine what the loss of the Chantix in the urine would have been over the course of the year. Therefore, it's hard to interpret what 0.58 means 1 year later without the suitability studies. And yet the CCA is confident that without looking at the suitability studies or knowing anything about them, they can be certain, beyond a reasonable doubt, that it would not impact what 0.58 would be interpreted as.
Counsel, didn't they withdraw their request for the suitability studies?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So that's the answer there?
That would be part of the answer. The appellate or defense at the court martial put on no evidence to show that the samples were somehow corrupted. So that, in addition to the fact that they withdrew their request for the suitability
samples. Why'd they withdraw them?
I don't know, Your Honor.
I mean,
it was his affirmative defense, so it would be something that they would be interested in, not the government. Honestly, Your Honor, I don't know.
Counsel, the earlier discussion that you were having with the court about the defense expert testifying that he didn't need any additional material, didn't that occur in regard to the defense's request for an appointment of a defense expert and not in the context of the Pfizer discovery request?
That is correct. During the 39A session, they were talking about the appointment of Mr. Moore.
So it really didn't go to the defense, to the Pfizer request. It was more as to whether or not this individual should be given granted as an expert witness.
That was the overarching subject matter. However, they were talking about also what Mr. Moore would have to review in order to do his study. If you recall, Your Honor, the judge was concerned that the defense was asking him to foot the bill for a research project. I think those were his exact words. And he was very concerned about that. And the defense counsel was trying to allay his fears by telling him he didn't need the clinical trials. And also Mr. Moore, I think, maybe to allay his fears. But also, I think, because he actually meant it, because he couldn't review all that documentation. But also at court-martial, ultimately at court-martial, he said the same thing, that the clinical trials were hundreds of thousands of pages long, and that reviewing the AERs were, quote-unquote, sort of his area. And so, again, there's no prejudice because, again, the defense's own expert said he didn't need it. And what's more is the defense counsel was quite clear that he was basing his defense strategy on what Mr. Moore told him. He said he would abandon the strategy, the Shantik strategy, if Mr. Moore said that it didn't hold water.
What is your answer on the FDA question? Did the FDA have everything, the universe of documents that Pfizer had, or the relevant portion?
At least at one time, they would have had the clinical trials. I don't know if they keep items like that. In any event, though, they would have probably more AERs than Pfizer would. Under a Code of Federal Regulations, Pfizer is obligated to submit any AERs it gets to the FDA. I don't know if there's a reciprocal obligation that the FDA has to submit any AERs it gets back to a pharmaceutical company. Again, Your Honor, as far as the clinical trials are concerned, at least at one time, they probably would have had them.
You're over the time. Are there any more questions up here? You can summarize in two sentences or nine or whatever.
Again, any errors that were committed at court-martial were harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and we ask that you refer the findings and sentence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The court now recognizes appellant for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So Judge Baker, if I were to tell my wife, the chemical engineer, that we were discussing Venn diagrams and the milligrams of a chemical compound, she would not believe me, but I think I figured it out. So before I launch into the first assignment of error that we briefed, and frankly, Your Honor, I wasn't trying to know what a Venn diagram was until my co-counsel told me, but the FDA had a small subsection of what Pfizer had. So Pfizer is the big balloon. The FDA is a small balloon inside of it.
What was missing that was critical and material?
The raw data, for one, and the underlying reports. Because, again, what the FDA gets are the summaries of the reports.
Can you illustrate what that means in context? What's in a summary and what's in a full AER?
Okay, well, we don't know what's in a full. In this case in particular, we don't know what's
in. No, not in this case, but in concept. Sure. If you're saying they get a summary, what does that mean? What's the difference between a summary and a full report?
When the when Pfizer accumulates all of this data, and it may be thousands upon thousands of people, physicians, other drug companies, individuals taking it.
Now I'm asking a simple question. Is an AER 20 pages and a summary a paragraph?
I don't know the exact page number.
You follow?
Yes,
I'm just trying to.
By analogy, that is correct, Judge.
And does the AER? What is there any other difference? What's in that the larger thing that's not in the summary?
It's our understanding that there may be, well, no, not in the idea, the raw data would not be in there. So I think that is the sum and substance.
Where can you point us to that this information about what is in an AER versus what is in a summary actually exists, as opposed to your best guesses as you stand here today?
We cited it in the joint appendix, Judge. I believe it's the testimony.
Well, the joint appendix is two volumes long.
I understand, Judge. Ours is one, and I believe it's in there, and I believe it's in Dr. Glenn Mullen's testimony.
The government's argument with respect to the, as I understand it, the government's argument is it doesn't, the failure to give the instruction on involuntary intoxication does not matter because in any event, when you get to the second prong of the test, no matter what view you take of the law, the second prong of the test is going to include ability to appreciate wrongfulness. And therefore, you can put the first prong can be mental disease or defect, or the first prong can be involuntary intoxication, or it can be some combination of the two. But it doesn't matter because you get to the second prong, and the appellant cannot demonstrate on these facts, regardless of the first prong, that he could not appreciate wrongfulness. What is your rebuttal, if any, to that?
I think it would go largely to the question that Judge Ryan asked, which is that we have no idea at all of whether the panel ever reached the second prong of the test.
Right, but the government's arguing that no reasonable panel, knowing these facts, could have found that this appellant did not appreciate the wrongfulness of his acts.
Well, Your Honor,
they're saying, as I understand their position, we'll grant you that. We'll grant you that the panel never had that opportunity. That was error. But they still had to have found the second prong, no matter what. And on these facts, no rational panel or whatever the right test is could have found those facts. Now, what's your response?
Your Honor, I would turn the court's attention to the testimony of Specialist Patterson. Joint appendix pages are joint appendix. Record of the page 121, record of trial, I believe, was 1008, or maybe I've got those backwards. In conjunction with the testimony of the two defense experts and Specialist Patterson's testimony that while he observed the appellant committing this heinous act, he was glossy-eyed, he appeared to be in another universe, and as he, I believe the exact words from Specialist Patterson were, you could look right through him. I believe that a panel, had they been properly instructed, could take the testimony of Specialist Patterson, combine it with the testimony of Dr. Glenn Mullen and Dr. Pancholi, and say, as a result of the involuntary intoxicating effects of Chantix, in combination with the testimony of the only eyewitness to the crime, we are not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant is guilty of premeditated murder. Based on that and the failure of a military judge to provide this, or rather the failure of a military judge in quashing the subpoena to Pfizer, the appellant has been denied a fundamentally fair trial, and we ask this court to reverse. Thank you, members of the court.
Members of the court, are there any other further questions? All right, the court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we'll stand in recess. Can't see the clock, so we'll stand in recess until 25 past the hour. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:25 a.m.